People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon introducing you to today's edition of People of Note. And I have an interesting person on today. Actually, all my guests seem to be interesting. I'm blessed by being able to meet interesting people. And today I'm talking to Bruce Cameron, who appears regularly on radio shows and is a well-known financial services industry public speaker. He's also a consultant and independent regarding retirement funds, or he was anyway. He's a regular radio commentator on personal finance issues and speaks at symposiums on the South African financial services industry. And prior to launching Personal Finance, way back in March 1996, Bruce was political editor of Business Report, and he's the winner of numerous journalism awards. So it's quite a pleasure to welcome you here, Bruce. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Rodney. Nice
you to are, be here. You haven't retired as such, have you, or are you still working away?
Still work away slightly. What I've done from when I retired 13 years ago is I've gradually extracted myself. I've stopped being a retirement fund consultant, particularly after because I was dealing with a bankrupt union fund.
Oh, dear.
And I found that quite overwhelming. So basically now I update books I write, particularly a retirement book. I now write with somebody else, Vota Furie, who's one of the top financial advisors in the country. He's actually a chartered accountant as well. Mm-hmm. And we have our own website as well, and I write columns for the website. So at the moment, for instance, I'm writing about people who are vulnerable. So they could be vulnerable because of their income, or they could be vulnerable because of their health. And it's actually the health thing that set me off on this, particularly older people, because older people are deaf, but banks all want you to phone them. So, you know.
And press this button and press that button.
And you can't contact them by email. It's a huge problem.
Mm. Let alone go in and see them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they're all the same. They're all trying to force people onto phones. Now, there's a double problem with phones, for instance, is that you've got no proof. They've got the proof. But you can't go back and say, okay, I said this on this day, you know. Mm-hmm. And whereas if you send an email, you have the proof.
Yes, yes.
I mean, this goes right back to the very start of personal finance. I'd been in Europe for a while, and I came back as business editor of the Argus. And while I was there, I started getting a lot of queries about life insurance products and the way people were being ripped off by life assurance products because of these surrender penalties you had. So if you got a policy and you surrendered it, they just took all your money back. But then also the banks. So I took a stroll down St. George's Mall and went into every bank and said, what are your charges? And each one said to me, you've got to open an account first before you can find out what our charges are.
Doesn't it make no sense whatsoever?
Whatsoever, yeah. And I started putting out the Saturday edition. I turned it on to Personal Finance and started questioning all these things that were going on. And then when the Irish took over independent newspapers, they set up Business Report as a publication that came out all over the country as a supplement to whichever newspaper was in that section. And it worked very well. And I said to them at the time, I would rather start a Personal Finance one. And they said, okay, we'll come and help us on Personal Finance for 2 years. They wanted me to be editor of Business Report, but I didn't want to move out to Cape Town because I love hiking. I like being in Cape Town.
I believe so. We're going to come to that. Yes, Bruce.
And they said, okay, you be the political reporter. So I'd been a political correspondent for the Daily News before that. So I said, yeah, happily. And I did it for 2 years. I made great friends with people like Jill Marcus and a lot of what was happening in Parliament was very good, and they started having inquiries about personal finance as well and reported on that as well. And the structure of Parliament changed in that before, when you had committee meetings, the press weren't allowed to go there. When the new system came in, the press was allowed to go there, and very firm questions were being answered. I'll give you an example. If you go back to commissions for financial advisors, the reason there was previously under the apartheid government, there were restrictions on commissions repaid. It was because the advisors were asking for more and more commissions. Financial services company went and said, no, we've got to stop, block this thing. It had nothing to do with the consumers. The consumers were still ripped off by the insurance companies. Yeah, so I've wandered a bit from what you asked me.
No, but it's interesting because you've touched a nerve, I think, for a lot of people, this business of trying to get a hold of your bank or to be able to talk to your bank manager or to make an appointment to go in and see him. And you phone and you get push this button, push that button for this, push that, push that, put that. And then you get hold of someone and it's very impersonal. And I can imagine for elderly people, I think people of any age, it must be very tricky.
Yeah, it is. And also the other thing is when you phone back the second time, you speak to another person.
Yes.
And you're going to go through the whole thing
absolutely,
again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that what you've done must have been a great help. It hasn't really helped, has it? Because
It will help because there's a bill that's coming out, what's called the COFI bill. And this restructures finance in South Africa. And within the COFI bill, there's something called treating customers fairly. There's six principles to it. They've got to sell things to you properly. They've got to maintain the service. And at the end, they must make sure that everything's done properly and you can properly complain. And this will change it because these companies will now have to apply treating customers fairly. And that includes how they correspond with you.
Hmm.
And I think when it comes in, it's been a long time coming, by the way, this bill, but they've said it's going to come before Parliament in the second half of this year, which I sincerely hope it does.
Well, let's all hope, because that's a bit of positive news at least. Yeah. You know, just now you spoke about when you write an email, you've got no proof, because the banks always say, this call will be recorded for whatever purposes. So they've got you speaking, but they could edit. It's not the same as you having your own copy. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, exactly. Now, I'll give you an example. I took a company to a adjudicator the other day. And I said, I want to do this thing by email. I don't want to be involved in phone calls for numerous reasons, which I explained. I know they weren't having anything to do with it. And they then sent I was trying to get hold of a policy. And normally you could just go onto the website and download the policy. But I went on, I kept throwing me out and saying, you can't get this. So the website had a problem. So I sent a complaint about it, and they weren't dealing with that complaint. And then when they did deal with it, they sent something from 3 years earlier trying to claim it was from this year.
Oh, you see, no, that's not right. So, so you did do an adjudication.
You actually see these things happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I now test everything, and I refuse to take phone calls. And now I've got one on the medical schemes, and I'm going to take it all the way and then write about it all.
Don't talk to me about medical schemes. I won't tell you which medical aid I belong to, but gosh, it's just almost impossible to get hold of someone to talk to that you can then phone back. As you said, you phone back and it's someone completely new who doesn't know your history.
You know what's interesting? That terrible murder of that medical aid in America where the guy went and shot the guy, which I think is absolutely terrible. But on the bullets were written, denied, defend, and it's a book written by a Rutgers professor and an expert in insurance. And when I say insurance, anything where there's a promise. So medical aid has got a promise.
Yes.
A life assurance has got a promise. That's what's part of the deal. And McKinsey's then went and gave American companies advice. And you don't have to do that. Look at your profits. And this is where a lot of the problems start. And it's time that everybody read that book and actually understood what's being said about them and why people get upset. And a lot of it has to do with being able to talk to someone who can come back with reasonable answers.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Bruce, let's relax and listen to a piece of music. And you've chosen Beethoven when he's 21st piano sonata, the famous Waldstein. Is this because you're fascinated by Beethoven, or why have you chosen this specifically?
It's actually quite a long story. I'm a baby boomer, quite obviously, being my age. And the first sort of classical music I ever heard was Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, the opening bars that were used on BBC.
That's right, famously for Victory.
Yeah, and my parents played it all the time. They were both in Europe. Well, my mother was in South Africa House during the war, and my father was a liaison officer for the British with South Africa. And they went through the entire war in London, virtually. And so they played that quite often. Then don't you know if you remember the Stanley Kubrick's film Clockwork Orange, which was banned in South Africa?
Yes, yes.
And I saw it in London, and a lot of it had to do with Beethoven.
Yes.
And he gets turned, basically. I mean, he was a terrible person. So nothing he did before was acceptable, his crime and everything else, but it also included Beethoven.
That's right. It's a very strange film.
Yeah. And the music appealed to me. I was very young then, early 20s, and I just got more and more into it. And eventually, a lot of the time I spend thinking about different things, both when I was a political journalist and when I was a financial journalist. And I'd lie on the floor and listen to Beethoven's Sixth. And Beethoven's Sixth is my all-time favorite.
The Pastoral Symphony.
Yes. And I listen to it, I mean, I don't know how many times a year I listen to it, but I listen to it a lot. And then from there, I just explored Beethoven more and more, and I just find the way he takes simple tunes and replicates it in thousands of different ways.
Absolutely. So this is the Piano Sonata now. We'll have this pastoral in a moment.
Yeah.
But this is Beethoven's Piano Sonata number 21, the Waldstein, and it's the third movement.
Thank you.
part of the third movement of Beethoven's Waldstein Sonata No. 21. And it was the first choice of my guest on People of Note this week, and his name is Bruce Cameron. We're talking about personal finance, we're talking about politics, we're talking about bad service from the banks, aren't we, Bruce? And also, we've got very high bank rates in this country, which is very irritating, on top of the bad service we get.
Yes, I agree. In fact, they should be paying us.
Yes, exactly. For
putting up with all the nonsense.
Yes, exactly. Bruce, when you went into this business, were you always, you told us that when you were very young, you listened to Beethoven and music. But what about journalism, political journalism and financial journalism? Is that something you always wanted to do?
I became a journalist not by actual choice. I grew up in a town called Kokstad.
In Natal, yes.
Yes, and there was a paper called the Kokstad Advertiser, and I used to work on it during the vacs, and it appealed to me. And there was a faction fight in the Transkei, and I went and covered it. And the Sunday Times found out I was there, and they didn't have a reporter there, so they phoned me and said, would you cover it? So I covered it for them. And they came back to me and said, would you be interested in becoming a journalist? And I wanted to become a lawyer.
Oh, really? Was that your yeah. aim? Oh.
And they said, no, come up for an interview. So I didn't know they'd fly me up there. I hitchhiked up there. And I walked in, and I was interviewed. I had to write various tests, and I saw this whole border people who were interviewing me. I don't know who the hell they were. I found out afterwards they were the editors of the Morning Group newspapers.
Just as well you didn't know. Yeah. You would have been a nervous wreck.
I would have been. And then I found out there were 970 applications.
Oh, my goodness. For that one job?
No, there were seven jobs.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And then I got it. And
this was on the Sunday Tribune?
No, the Sunday Times.
The Sunday Times.
It was the Rand Daily Mail as well.
Right.
I went up there and they had a paper that they trained journalists on. At the time, universities didn't offer training courses for journalists. The two big groups, the Independent and, well, the Argus and the Morning Group, trained their own journalists and the Afrikaans groups too.
Mm-hmm. It seems strange, doesn't it, that in those days when journalism was really quite good, there was no official university training.
But they set up the Northern Reporter, and you were trained on that. And by very good journalists. I mean, Rex Gibson was the editor.
Wow.
And Gavin Stewart was the news editor. Gavin Stewart landed up lecturing at Rhodes. So you were very well trained.
But didn't you also work on the Sunday Tribune? Why do I think of you as being on the Sunday Tribune, which is the Durban newspaper?
The Durban newspaper. Occasionally I used to write the Tribune, but I was on the Daily News. I was a political reporter and political correspondent of
the Daily News, based in Durban.
Based in Durban, yeah.
Okay. And so, then the financial thing, how did that come in?
Well, that it developed because when I was in Parliament, I used to do a lot of the budget coverage. The reason is I knew what the difference was between a billion and a million. Most journalists, it's an interchangeable term.
Yes. Yeah. Unless they got that amount of money, of course.
Anyway, so I used to do most of the budget coverage, and when they were considering releasing Mandela, there was a debt standstill in South Africa. There'd been no access to capital markets from 1983. We were facing major financial sanctions, which to me was the main cause of why the government changed this country. Because it wasn't the fighting.
No, it was money.
It was money.
Yeah.
And they knew they were releasing Mandela. It hadn't been announced. And I got a phone call saying, would you be part of a team that's been set up that has nothing to do with the government? And would your group second you to us? So, which they did. So about 2 months before Mandela was released, I joined the team. L.T. Links was the head of it. He was dean of the economics faculty at Western Cape. Myself, and then there was a guy from one of the banks who was a trader. And the three of us went to Zurich, and we set up offices in Zurich. But we weren't answerable to anyone. We were diplomats. We were appointed as diplomats. I was a consul. LT was the Consul General.
Yes.
But we weren't answerable to Foreign Affairs. We were only answerable to the Department of Finance. And we then set up and we travelled around the world and we spoke about the debt standstill and how it was being dealt. We dealt with the circumstances in South Africa, more the financial side than the political side, although there were times of politics as well. At one stage in Paris, I was asked to go and speak to a group that supported South Africa, but they were so right-wing, it was unreal. They were calling P.W. Botha a communist.
Oh, my goodness. Right.
So we stopped dealing with those sort of groups.
Yeah.
And we concentrated mainly on the banks, the financial press and things like that. So from there, I then got the experience, a lot more experience on financial stuff. The bond market, I became an absolute expert in the bond market because we then did the first major overseas borrowing through Deutsche Bank in Germany.
Right.
Well, it's the first big loan we did. But I was only seconded to the Department of Finance for 3 years. Came back, and I didn't want to go back into politics, and I said, can I go into finance? And they thought this was wonderful because not many journalists want to go into finance.
I was going to say, it's very specialized.
Yeah. And that's how I landed up in it.
In personal finance. How many people know about that little group of diplomats that went across? Was that general knowledge? It couldn't have been in those days.
It was general knowledge. It was written about, but not. We acted very much. We attended a lot of conferences. We spoke extensively to banks. Mm-hmm. We did speak to the media and tried to explain what the changes were about and everything else.
Were you able to say that Mandela was about to be released?
No, but by the time I got there, Mandela had been released.
Oh, had, okay.
Yeah. So there was a change in attitude. I mean, before, if we'd been there 2 years before, nobody would have spoken to
us. That's true. It's amazing, as you say, F.W. de Klerk was very brave, but it was money.
Yeah.
The country is about to go under.
Yeah, it couldn't have survived. The interesting thing was I was initially opposed to financial sanctions, but when I got over there and understood it in more depth, financial sanctions was the answer.
That strangled us, yeah. Bruce, let's have an excerpt now from your favorite Beethoven Symphony No. 6, the Pastoral Symphony, which you say is so special to you. And the third movement is the lovely little scherzo. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Part of the third movement of Beethoven's Symphony No. 6, the lovely Pastoral Symphony, and a choice of my guest, who's a Beethoven fanatic here, Bruce Cameron, but we're talking to him as a financial journalist. He's written a book called The Ultimate Guide to Retirement in South Africa. Actually, you've written a number of books, haven't you, Bruce?
Yeah, quite a few.
Are all your books to do with finance?
No, I've written a couple of travel books.
Oh, travel as well?
One travel book and on South Africa, which is still being published, I think, about 20 years later. Mm-hmm. And I was part of a project of Reader's Digest, which wrote an updated history of South Africa. I was part of a group of writers who wrote that as well.
Oh, right. I think I remember that very clearly, book. And it was very well received, talking about the history of South Africa. But let's move away from finances and politics for the moment, because earlier on you said you're a great hiker.
Yeah.
And the travel part, did that come as a result of your love of hiking and wandering around countries, or what made you interested in the world of travel journalism?
I never wrote about travel, ever. I thought that was something that I enjoyed doing. I like traveling. I like going to new countries. At one stage, I spent a year just driving around Europe in a motorized caravan.
Oh, my. Okay.
In 1975.
The thing that you sleep in as well.
Yeah, you sleep in as well. And it was totally different then, because you could basically park at the side of the road.
Yes, wherever you are.
Right? Yeah, and the whole tourism was different. The thing that always reminds me of the difference was at St. Peter's in Rome, you could walk up to the Pietà and you could actually touch it.
Wow, yeah, imagine that.
And then the guy took that hammer to it and busted it apart, and now there's a big glass screen there. Mm-hmm. The whole thing just changed in Europe.
So, and all these great paintings are glassed in and all that sort of thing.
Yeah. All because of the damage that's been caused and why people do such stupid things.
It's incredible to think that someone would do that to something as precious as that.
Yeah.
But you ended up writing anyway about travel.
Yes, but more on social media I've written about. That was what happened was the last big overseas hike I did in Turkey. And I wrote a lot about it because a friend of mine was dying of cancer. And I was writing for my family, and I also sent copies to him because he had wanted to go to Turkey. And he said to me, write it for everybody. Amazing guy, John Lloyd. He worked for the Argus, and he fought cancer like I've never seen before. Incredible person. And so that's why I started writing about travel. Before, I'd never written about it.
Okay.
But that was an incredible hike. I did it on my own, which people thought I was absolutely crazy about. And you hike almost every day double the height of Table Mountain, up and down. It's incredibly mountainous. And up in the hills, you stayed in very strange places.
Sure, especially in Turkey, yes.
Yeah. I mean, one place I stayed in didn't even have a kitchen inside. They cooked it everything outside, but the meals are brilliant in Turkey. Mm-hmm. The thing about, and the same applies to Egypt and other places I've gone to, the cultural side is so, civilization goes back so far in Turkey to so many different, from Romans to Greeks to Phoenicians, you name it, they've all been there.
The crossroads of East and West, Constantinople,
And
now Istanbul.
Yeah. When you're on the coastal side, they then police you and you've got to pay to go in and things like that, which is fine. But up in the mountains, it's all open. There's nobody looking after it. You just suddenly come across these ruins while you're up in the mountains.
Wow. But Bruce, you and you keep up your hiking, don't you? Because you hike a lot here in Cape Town.
Yeah.
Talking about Table Mountain.
Yeah. Well, I live in Tombo's Kloof, so I hike straight onto Lion's Head and Signal Hill.
Right. Must keep you really rather fit. Because you had, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but I know we said, we were chatting about this interview before you came in, that you had quite a severe stroke recently.
About 7 years ago, I had the stroke.
But it had a curious effect on you. Would you be prepared to share that with us?
Yeah, I lost my speech and a lot of my balance.
Did you lose your speech altogether?
Altogether. I couldn't say a word. In fact, the first word I learned, I counted to 10.
Oh, really? Okay. Okay.
But it took me a while. And then I came out, I went to a speech therapist. But you never recover totally. I had an x-ray done last year, and I've still got a hole in my brain sort of thing from where the stroke affected me.
Wow.
So I suffer from something called aphasia, where I forget proper nouns. I know it, I can see it in my mind, but I can't get the word out. And this is the other problem with the banks, because this is one reasons why I insist on doing things in writing. My balance I got back by balancing on stones on lion's head, basically.
Good yeah. Gracious. Without hurting yourself.
Without hurting myself, yeah. But I've got to be careful now, still. So I don't do crazy hikes. You know, I used to go up India Fenster. Okay. I actually did it last year for the first time in years. It was not a very pleasant experience.
They always say that's the very dangerous one.
Yeah.
And Bruce, the speech thing, I mean, obviously I'm fascinated by that because radio, it's all about speech. Mm. You went to a speech therapist, you say, who literally taught you to speak from scratch.
Yeah. But they also taught you tricks. If you can't remember a word, try and use another word. And that seems to work quite well. But this is why there's a problem with proper nouns, because often you can't replace the proper noun.
Oh, that's true. Proper noun, of course.
Yeah. But people I know accept it. You know, I once went to a dinner party a few years ago, and a woman turned to me and said, "There's something wrong with you."
Oh, really? How rude.
And she was a psychologist as well.
Oh.
Which was, it made it even worse.
Yes.
So I just said to her, "Well, I had a stroke last year."
Did that shut her up?
And that shut her up. I didn't hear from her again.
But, I mean, in your career, you've done lots of talking and lectures and things. Have you stopped doing that now as well?
Yeah, I have, yeah. I've done one or two, but I find it very difficult. Mm. But I prepare extensively before I did. But I've decided now I'm not doing that anymore.
Right.
That's too much pressure.
Just to go back to retirement, because it said that you're a trustee of retirement funds, and you said to me, "No, you used to be, but you weren't anymore." And you've written this book, The Ultimate Guide to Retirement, which you say you keep updating. I see this is the third edition you've brought here. What was it about retirement that attracted you? Was it like possibly the same as the banks? Older people not knowing what's going on?
Exactly. That, you know, if you even take this latest two-pot system where you can withdraw from it, there are going to be terrible implications from that. If people withdraw, they're not going to have money to retire on. Simple as that.
Yeah.
And what I found was people didn't understand the policies they were buying and building up, and they didn't know what to buy when they matured those policies and they retired. Something that was introduced in the early 90s called a living annuity. And it's invested in the stock market and you get what you get. Whereas before you had the DB funds where you, it was a factor of the number of years you worked there and you got your pension based on that. But the advice given on these living annuities, I've got nothing against living annuities, but they must be sold properly. So what people were doing was putting them into high risk investments, which failed. And so many people, and then they drew too much as well, because you can draw between 2.5 and 7.5. And they were drawing more than 10%. You can't draw 10% from your capital and expect to retire. Mm-hmm. You have to draw less than 5%. So a lot of that was coming up. People didn't understand retirement. They thought it was just easy. You worked, you retired, and you got a pension.
Yeah.
And there's the lovely saying of British Underground saying, "Mind the gap." And in retirement, there was a major gap.
Mind the gap. Let's have another piece of music now, Bruce. And I see we've got an excerpt from Les Miserables coming up.
Yeah.
Was this a musical that meant a lot to you?
Yes, it did. It was the political side of it that came through there. I think it's a brilliant musical. Mm-hmm. And the songs mean so much to me. And I saw before the fall of apartheid. And, I mean, I've always been totally opposed to apartheid and everything that went with it. And it shows that you get good people. But the trouble is good people die so often because the people conducting the wars are hard people. Mm-hmm. But they don't go to the front line. They weren't like the kings of Middle Ages.
They sit in
boardrooms. P.W. Botha was an excellent example. He didn't send his son to war, you know.
Exactly.
So, And you've got Trump behaving like an absolute idiot all the time.
Let's not talk about him.
So that musical means so much to me, both from appreciating the music and also the plot of it as well.
Right, right. Well, you've chosen Empty Chairs and Empty Tables.
Yeah.
So let's listen to that.
There's a grief that can't be spoken, and there's a pain that goes on and on. Empty chairs at empty tables, now my friends are dead and gone. Here they talked of revolution, here it was they lit the flame. Here they sang about tomorrow, and tomorrow never came. From the table in the corner, they could see a world reborn. And they rose with voices ringing, and I can hear them now, the very words that they had sung became their last communion. On the lonely barricade at dawn, my friends, forgive me that I live and you are gone. There's a grief that can't be spoken, there's a pain that goes on and on. Phantom faces at the window, phantom shadows on the floor, empty chairs, empty tables where my friends will meet no more. Oh, my friends, don't ask me what your sacrifice was for. Empty chairs and empty tables where my friends will sing.
From the musical Les Miserables, Empty Chairs and Empty Tables, as you said, Bruce, what a powerful musical that is, actually, and especially for us here in South Africa who lived through the apartheid system. Anyway, my guest is Bruce Cameron, and we're talking about the world of finance, personal finance, hedge funds, politics, retirement, your book, The Ultimate Guide to Retirement. But in your days as a journalist, it seems that you had certainly some interesting experiences, because you told me you were one of the first people to go into Cuba as a journalist when we were still, well, at war with Cuba, actually, if you think about it.
In Angola, yeah. Yes. What happened was they captured a South African soldier by the name of Poppenfuss, and they took him to Cuba. So I thought, maybe they'll let me in to go and interview him. So I phoned the Cuban ambassador at the United Nations and said to him, I'd like to come to Cuba to come and see how you're looking after our guy. And I didn't hear anything for 3 days. And then suddenly I get a phone call back from him saying, you're welcome, come.
Wow, you must have been very surprised.
I was. So anyway, it was an incredible flight to get there because there were sanctions against South African air and against Cuban air. So I had to flew to Lisbon, from Lisbon to Madrid. Madrid, I had to get a visa from the Cuban embassy in Madrid. Then flew to Nova Scotia.
Wow.
On Cuban air to Nova Scotia, and then from Nova Scotia down to Cuba.
What a roundabout route.
Sure.
It's far north. It's Nova Scotia.
Yeah. And then what happened on the Cuban plane between Spain was they loaded a weightlifting team, Cuban weightlifting team, one weight litter, three seats. The people sat in the aisle.
Goodness me. Are you serious?
Yeah. Well, I've got a seat, fortunately, but
yeah.
And there's no business class. It's just one, we're all together. And it was absolutely fascinating.
What was it like arriving in Cuba, where we were taught they were the sort of awful people?
Well, I was met separately, and when I got there, I was given an interpreter who was a lecturer at the university, an English lecturer, a driver, and a security guy. The security guy, not to watch what was happening outside, but to make sure I didn't get out of hand.
Right, right.
But a wonderful welcome I got from that.
And you met the prisoner.
I met the prisoner, but that wasn't my main intention. I wanted to interview Castro.
Oh, I see.
So the South African prisoner, I interviewed him. He didn't know he was in Cuba, by the way. He thought he was still in Angola.
Who?
The prisoner.
The prisoner. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
Not too bright, but, I mean, and he was really upset because he was deserted, he said, by the people he was fighting with. He got shot in his backside, mm-hmm. badly. Mm-hmm. And when I got there, I had to watch a movie of the operation. Now, in my life, there's one thing I never wanted to be, was be involved in medicine. And I had to sit through this three-hour movie of this operation on his rear end.
That must have been awful. What a bizarre thing to have to do.
Yeah. Anyway, so I spent about 2 weeks there.
Okay.
And
so you didn't get to interview Castro.
I spoke to his brother, who then became...
He did, indeed. Yeah.
Raul. So, but that's even what's funny, because I got woken at 3 a.m. I was blindfolded. I was driven around Havana for about an hour.
So that you got confused as to where you were.
Then we arrived where we were, and I immediately recognized the place where we were. I'd seen it while we were driving around. But it's a fascinating place. I mean, their health system is absolutely incredible. They've got a system where you start off at the bottom end and you gradually get referred up. In the end, if you're really ill, you land up in a building that was a bank and it's been converted to a hospital where they deal with you. Fascinating system. And mm-hmm. I've always been amazed that South Africa has got such close associations with Cuba,
yes.
that we haven't set up a similar system.
Because we've been using their doctors.
Yeah, so but we should set up the system as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. So it sounds as though you can't retire at all yet, Bruce, because you've got all these interests, banks ripping people off, people not understanding retirement, medical things. So keep fighting, will you?
Thank you.
Bruce, we're going to take the last piece of music now, which I know you, in your thing that you sent me, you do enjoy opera. You come to Cape Town Opera, you come to our concerts, and Verdi is much in the news because of the recent production of Aida. But this is from Nabucco, and it's arguably one of Verdi's most famous choruses, which is the Hebrew Slaves, the chorus of the Hebrew Slaves. But you've asked for it to be sung by the Leacock Prison Choir.
It goes back to the politics again, because I believe all people, most people, are essentially good. You get people like Trump who...
Yes.
And in South Africa, you had Brown who ripped off pensioners. Or, but most people are good. And I think a lot of people land up in prison because of circumstance. And having not being able to get a job, whatever, there can be all sorts of reasons why people land up in prison. And I think if somebody adapts to music, it's a good sign.
Very good sign.
And I know it's not a perfect piece of music, I mean, from the singing of it, but it's wonderful. I think it's, putting something together like that is great.
Well, Bruce Cameron, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you for sharing some memories of your long and distinguished career. Notice I said distinguished as well. All the stuff you've done. Your CV here runs to pages and pages and pages of all your awards and all the things you've done. So thank you for sharing with us. And as I said, keep going.
Well, one thing I'm going to keep going is listening to you, because you're my favorite an answer.
Oh, Bruce.
Without doubt.
Therefore, you're allowed to come back one day. Thank you, Bruce Cameron, as we listen to the Chorus of the Hebrew Slaves from Nabucco by Verdi.
Thank you.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.